720 WGN, Justin Kaufman with you tonight until 11 o'clock when Nick DiGiulio takes over. Wow, what an hour that was to do the argument about Chicago movies, Dark Knight, and About Last Night. Thanks to Mark Baser and Allison Cuddy. About Last Night inches out the victory. And just a great... I loved it. It was like a thesis on Chicago movies. Both of them came prepared, and I really appreciate it. Moving from Chicago movies to Chicago music, in studio with me now, author Aaron Cohen. His book is called Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power. This book is not just about some of the great Chicago artists like Curtis Mayfield or even Chaka Khan. It's about how, I don't know if it's something in the water here in Chicago where social change and black music kind of came together. And it's different than a lot of other cities in America when it comes to what they were able to accomplish. Aaron Cohen, a longtime writer. He's also written a book about Aretha Franklin. Aaron, great to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's really great to be here.
It's amazing to think this way because I really want to get into some of these great artists. And it's funny because last night we talked about the film Coolie High. That was one of the things. There was a lot of talk about soul music and R&B. And as you pointed out, a lot of the music that was in Coolie High was not from Chicago.
No, and it was all Motown music because Motown was footing the bills. Now, Coolie High is a great film, and Motown music was very popular in that neighborhood. As you talked about yesterday, Coolie mm-hmm. High takes place in the Cabrini Green housing project in Chicago in the 1960s. And that housing project, so many great Chicago musicians came out of that. Curtis Mayfield in particular, Terry Collier, Otis Lavelle, The Impressions, mm-hmm. all came out of Cabrini Green. So to have so much great Chicago music come from this place, a movie should include some of those songs, I would think.
And I think, as they talked about it yesterday, that it probably was much more about money than it was about anything else. That was an indie film.
Oh,
I'm sure they got one to get the money.
Absolutely.
But what is your interest in this, in documenting and writing the story of Chicago soul music?
The music itself is so incredible. That's the first and primary important reason to write about any kind of music. But I've also always been fascinated by those connections between how social and cultural changes shape the music. But here in Chicago, the musicians themselves became change agents directly through Jerry Butler becoming mm-hmm. Cook County Commissioner, but also in a lot of indirect ways. For instance, you have young African Americans claiming all kinds of music for their own. You had people like James Mack, who was a teacher and an arranger, and people like Charles Stepney, who was a musician producer, showing these young musicians that all music is yours. It could be European classical music, it's yours. Johnny Pate bringing jazz and classical arranging into these Impressions records, showing that mm-hmm. you can do anything through your music. And it's such an important statement to make here in Chicago.
You know, for all the success that Motown Records had, and you think about some of the other big cities and their music scenes, it is interesting that a lot of those names that you just mentioned, including the lead name Curtis Mayfield, almost became the soundtrack for the civil rights movement. And there are a lot of other music as well, but I think about those artists when you think of Dr. King, when you think of throughout the 70s and telling the real story of what was happening in urban America, all the way up to the election of Harold Washington right here in Chicago.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, musicians, as I say in the book, were involved in Harold Washington's election. They were involved in the campaign. I spoke with several musicians who were very much a part of Harold Washington's rallies. And a little side note to that is I was talking with Gene Barge, who was a great band leader, still very active. He's about 90 years old, and he was involved with Operation Breadbasket in the 1960s and in the 70s with Operation Push. And he was also involved in Harold Washington's election. And when I interviewed Gene Barge, he was telling me about playing at Harold Washington's rallies, and I mentioned, you know, I don't remember, Gene, if you were at the Harold Washington rally that I attended at the Hotel Belmont in 1983, but I don't remember for two reasons. Number one, it was because I was almost 14 years old, and number two was at that rally I was standing next to Muhammad Ali. So I don't.
I was distracted.
I was distracted, but I'll take your word for it, Mr. Barge.
Well, in this interview, and we're going to talk throughout the 9 o'clock hour here, we get into some of the stories, specific stories about some of these great Chicago artists and their impact on social change. I mean, that's really what this is about. The book is called Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power. Aaron Cohen is the author. He is in studio. He's got it. Where is this? You're going to be at 2112. The
2112 Arts Incubator on next Wednesday at 6 p.m. 2112 is at 4245 North Knox Avenue, right by the Montrose stop on the Blue Line. And one of the things I really stress in my book is the importance of arts education and the public school programs, the city college programs that singers and musicians in Chicago came out of, and they brought that training to their music. So it's very important for me to be at an arts incubator to talk about this book. So 2112 on Wednesday at 6 p.m.
All right. Aaron Cohen is in studio tonight here on 720 WGN. We'll take a quick break, come back, and continue the conversation. Stay with us. It is 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. Aaron Cohen, his book Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power, is actually on the end of year list for the Chicago Tribune. Congratulations
Thank
on
you.
That.
Thank you very much. That was great.
The book, it's a fascinating story about a music scene in Chicago that gets overlooked. Maybe not particularly by the African American community. They'll know how important and vastly important it was, but it gets overlooked when you think about the importance of black music because of Motown Records, because of what was happening with Marvin Gaye and others in different cities around the country. Mm-hmm. But take us to where, you know, I would think the 40s and 50s and even into the 60s, black music in Chicago was dominating.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that I really wanted to stress in my book was how much the jazz music of the 40s and 50s shaped what became soul music of the 60s, because there were jazz artists like Johnny Pate, who was playing bass in jazz clubs, learning how to jam in different keys. And so when he became an arranger for the Impressions in the 1960s, he brought those jazz skills into the studio, and it was a combination of jazz-trained artists like himself.
That's interesting, and yeah.
Young musicians like Curtis Mayfield, who was an autodidact. He taught himself, I'm going to play guitar this way, and it sounds in this very, you know, unique way. And so Johnny Pate was like, okay, how do I transpose this to create these strings? Well, I brought my jazz training to it. Or people like the producer-arranger Charles Stepney, who was playing piano and vibes with jazz musicians like Eddie Harris, bringing that into the studio. And then you had young singers who grew up singing gospel music.
That's different. You hear a lot of those stories about people who were singing in their church or singing. Their dad might have been a preacher. I mean, you hear that over and over and over when it comes to a lot of these successful, well-known Chicago black musicians.
Absolutely. And also one of the interesting things about that is that the churches, the African-American churches, have been so diverse in Chicago. And somebody who's coming up singing from a sanctified background, like Curtis Mayfield and Jerry Butler, would sound different than someone like Patty Drew, who sang coming up from a Methodist background. And then you had people like the Shylights, who were Catholic, and they brought how their harmonies sounded in the Catholic Church. They brought those into the records that they made in the latter 60s. So the diversity, and I also, in terms of using Black Cultural Power as a subtitle, I always feel that diversity is strength. So that there were so many diverse musical strains in Chicago, there were and still are to this day, that's what made part of what made the music so strong.
That's so interesting. To think that the religious backgrounds changed or at least inspired how people sang.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't even think about that. Right.
And that was something that I learned from talking to people. I would learn, you know, I mentioned talking with Marshall Thompson from the Shylights, and he told me about bringing the Catholic
tradition in. I would never think that way. I mean, I would think, okay, church, gospel, got it, but I would never think that someone coming up in the Methodist church would sound different than someone coming up in the Catholic church.
And then we had groups like the Dells, Chuck Barksdale, who I interviewed, who mm-hmm. sang with the Dells, and he told me how every member of the Dells represented a different faith. And he said, but when we came together, it was perfect.
That's great. I think about, obviously we talk about the Impressions and the Shylights and the Dells and the doo-wop groups of the 50s and early 60s. Chicago had I mean, this major, they obviously had the Michigan Avenue Record Row, but you also had these big events that were happening at theaters like the Regal and other places that were almost like American Idol. They were Chicago Battle of the Bands, and these doo-wop groups would go, you know, sort of face off against each other. And it was the real deal.
It was the real deal. The Regal, which was certainly like the Apollo in Harlem, was the place where everybody wanted to play, and that was, you know, over in Bronzeville. And in Cabrini Green, there was the Seward Park Fieldhouse, where those groups that I mentioned from Cabrini Green would practice, rehearse. They would have their rivalries. And the other interesting thing, too, and this gets back to what I was saying a second ago about the diversity of music, and that when the Impressions were coming up and they had a manager, Eddie Thomas,
mm-hmm.
and Eddie Thomas would take them to Mr. Kelly's, the sophisticated jazz club in a very different part of the north side of Chicago, which was very different than where they were coming out of in Cabrini Green, even though geographically it wasn't that far. Eddie Thomas would take them there to show them that there's this other way of performing, other way of singing. You know, I just mentioned the Dells, and they would work with Dinah Washington, the great jazz vocalist. And again, so bringing in, you know, not just playing in the clubs where you would expect young R&B singers to play, but having this connection to the jazz scene as well also shaped what made the sound here so distinctive.
That's, again, that's very interesting to think about, because you do know Chicago to be a blues and jazz town, and you don't always think about them interacting necessarily with R&B or with the soul music movement like we're talking about today. But you're right. When you think about all of those players coming over and those producers coming over to take what they learned in those communities, bring them into soul music, it is a different sound that you're going to get in Baltimore, that you're going to get in Detroit, that you're going to get in New York City.
And that's one of the, actually, I want to also say, I didn't do in the book so many comparisons with other cities because, you know, I interviewed 100 people in Chicago. I looked through countless articles from the Chicago Defender. So to make a fair comparison to Detroit or Philadelphia or Memphis, I'd have to go to Detroit, spend 7 years in Detroit, spend 7 years in
Aaron,
Memphis.
Aaron, come on. We need that from you. We're doing a radio segment.
Which, don't get me wrong. I would love to do that. I would love to have 20 years in these different cities, but it's not really feasible in terms
of... But regardless, the idea that Chicago has a different sound, meaning that... And it may not even be the sound. It may be the fact that Chicago's soul music combined with the fact that they were enlightened and had social cultural change messages in the music, plus the fact that you're in this hotbed of jazz and blues and that people know this, and we talked about a little bit, referenced Michigan Avenue and Record Row, there does seem to be this melting pot diverse concept of how this music comes together.
Oh, absolutely. And at the same time, or not the same time, but later in the 1960s, when you had the rise of what could be called Afrocentric thought from people like Keelan Phil Curran, who ran the Afro Arts Theater. And he came out of the mystical Sun Ra band, Sun Ra Orchestra,
mm-hmm.
and he also was involved with the battle of the musicians' unions, when there was a white musicians' union and a black musicians' union, and there was a struggle to integrate them. And Phil Curran felt that after the musicians' unions were integrated, it did not help black musicians like it should have. So he set up his own operations. One of them was the Afro Arts Theater, where this proto-Afrocentric thought was taught, where they were taught about African music. They were taught different African languages. They were taught African instruments. And that's where Earth, Wind, and Fire and Chaka Khan came out of.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's great. That's awesome. Aaron Cohen's in studio. We're talking about his book, Move On Up. When we did mention Record Row, and I think about, I guess the question would be, was it hard for Chicago musicians to break into any sort of mainstream work because of Motown? Motown was the place to be, and it seemed like the only place to be for musicians, African-American musicians who wanted to do soul music. So did Chicago was Chicago able to create its own identity or its own business model without going to Motown?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, kind of the opposite. In fact, Motown had to get their records played on WVON here in Chicago. So it was very important for Motown to do what they could do to get played on this station, which was WVON being a very popular African-American radio station. But Chicago musicians like Curtis Mayfield were able to form their own musical identities. The musicians who were affiliated with Chess Records were able to do what they did. And then there was so many of these small startup companies in Chicago, so many companies where they were just started by one person wanting to press up a few 45s, press up, you know, maybe an album if they could. They, you know, were able to get their money together, press them, get them out in the world. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe that Motown, as big as it was, as popular as it was, and as great as it was, harmed musicians in Chicago in any tangible way.
I think about the, when you talk about pressing 45s and trying to get that music out, I mean, it's really sort of independent spirit, not unlike what we're having today in music, any kind of music in 2019. Everybody had, it's almost like a DIY approach. Was it really just the name of the game was to get it on Chicago radio? Was the idea for Curtis Mayfield, for the Impressions, for the Shy Lights, for anyone, say, I got to get it on Chicago radio? That's how we have to do it. Or was it more word of mouth, playing little house parties and things like that, trying to get the word out?
WVON was so important. But then later other stations too, like WJPC, which was owned by Johnson Publications, and, you know, WGCI. But in the 1960s, VON was so important in terms of playing music, in terms of reporting on what was going on with the civil rights movement, in terms of what was going on with the students who were, you know, fighting segregation in the schools. But WVON was the powerhouse for African American music, and people had to do what they could to get on WVON. And I go into a little bit in the book about what people did to get on WVON. I think it's no secret at this point what people did to get played on that station. But the station was crucial.
Yeah. Aaron Cohen's my guest. The book is called Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power. He's going to be doing, is it a reading? Is it a conversation?
I'll be speaking. I don't like to read from the book. Yeah. I like to engage in conversation. About me reading a little bit and discussing the book. And if people have questions, it'd be great to entertain questions. And one of the great things about doing the events that I've been doing in Chicago is some of the people from the book show up, and you know, I give them a platform to tell their stories.
That's great. The book is a collection of interviews of great musicians from the era of Chicago soul music. And Aaron is going to be having an event at 2112, which is the Arts Incubator on the Northwest Side. We'll give out
on Wednesday. Yeah.
On Wednesday, next Wednesday, coming up here. Aaron Cohen, my guest here on 720 WGN. We'll take a break. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. The great Curtis Mayfield here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman in studio. Aaron Cohen, the book Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power. And made it to the end of the best of list on the Chicago Tribune. And we'll talk again about the event that's coming up next week. Curtis Mayfield is a great, I mean, I'm glad that Pete's playing this song, because Curtis Mayfield is one of the Chicago's greatest artists. And he has a tremendous life in music, because as part of the Impressions, he was right in there with the doo-wop bands that we know and love, and his solo work became the soundtrack for 1970s African-American life in cities.
Absolutely.
What I always liked about Curtis Mayfield is, even when he was doing music that was much more standard, he still did it with a message, and that seemed to resonate.
He did, and people get ready. You know, We're a Winner, a song that
Harold Washington used. Yeah.
And then was also, subject to not being played on certain radio stations. I talk about that in the book and how much of a controversy that was. But also, I mean, his guitar sound, too. And I think just having a singular guitar sound in and of itself is a message. So, and also his business practice of owning himself, owning his record company, owning his publishing with, you know, Eddie Thomas. So this self-owning entrepreneur, mm-hmm, also sends a message apart from the lyrics of his songs.
He, almost became emblematic of social justice and social change. I mean, we talked about We're a Winner, and we talk about Our Winner, and some of the music he was doing solo. Were songs that became anthems. Did he set out to do that? Was that something that Curtis Mayfield was like, okay, I am all about black cultural power, and I want to be able to be the anthem for a movement? Or was it almost adopted as that?
Well, I think he wrote songs that resonated. And I think he, of course, set out to write songs that would resonate and resonate deeply. And he succeeded in that.
Yeah. It's interesting because we talked about Seward Park and the Near North Side. We mentioned a little bit in Cooley High the idea that that's where that all took place. But it still stands. The field house still stands there. And it's a different kind of park now. It's multi-use. There's a lot going on there. But to think back to that time, that's where the Impressions and some of the other bands that you mentioned and some of the other musicians were starting out. I mean, I know it sounds kind of a caricature or stereotype, but the idea of a garbage can and a fire and the doo-wop guys around it, I mean, there was this kind of sense of musical expression coming out of that area at that time.
Well, it was a real community back then, and it was a community that in the early stages, that sort of musical commitment, that sort of artistic burgeoning was encouraged. And the Seward Park Fieldhouse to this day, now I might have been projecting when I would go there and start singing myself in some of those rooms just to, you know, see here if the acoustics are still good. I'm not going to duplicate that. I was by myself. So, you know, no one was subjected to my singing,
right.
But you know, that also was part of it. Having a space that the echo is so beautiful in that room, those rooms.
Yeah. I think about today, because you go into the book and you talk a little bit about, as you mentioned, Earth, Wind, and Fire and Chaka Khan and artists that came out of the 80s, because this is really a book that spans interviews from the 60s to the 80s. How did the music change? I mean, because you mentioned some of the teachings that were coming from the theater, and you mentioned, you know, those bands, Earth, Wind, and Fire and Chaka Khan. But did the messages and the music and the idea of what black cultural power change in the 80s as opposed to what it was in the 70s and before that?
Well, I end the book in the 1980s and with the election of Harold Washington, because I had to end it somewhere. So
you could have kept going, right?
I could have kept going.
10 more years.
Well, that's the thing is, we'll get back to the 80s in a sec, but I did include an afterword, because one of the nicest things I found out in writing the book is, as I was ending the writing process in 2017, there was such a burgeoning of young talent from Chicago, mm-hmm. and great young artists like Raven Lanae, Jamila Woods, who I mentioned. If I had another year to write the book, I would have mentioned Jamila Woods' younger sister, Ayanna Woods, who's terrific. Tasha, who I saw at the Pitchfork Festival this past summer. So there's a great musical scene in Chicago now, mm-hmm. people who are drawing on R&B, drawing on spoken word, drawing on jazz, drawing on rock.
They're doing the same thing that was done in the 60s here. I mean, the same thing.
It's incredible. And they're very young artists, too, who I did not know about when I started writing, because they were not artists at that time. They were so young. But to get back to the 80s, so I end it by talking about house music. And I don't go that much into it because I felt that there would be another book on house music. But it took the changes from disco, and it took that sort of beat, the tempo from disco, mm-hmm. the technology, mm-hmm. but there were Chicagoans like Vince Lawrence who invented something completely different out of it in 1980s in Chicago and became very successful at it. Yeah. Vince, if you're listening, hi.
There's no doubt. I mean, to see the impact that house music has had on Chicago music and music fans.
And I felt that was a whole nother story, but I felt that was a good place to end it, along with the rise of Harold Washington, is this rise of this original form of African-American dance music in Chicago that became known as house. It wasn't called house originally, but has since become known as house.
But again, it captures the spirit that the book captures, that you talk about Chicago soul music. It captures this hybrid. House music was a hybrid of other what other people were doing in other places, and it all comes together into what the sound is here in Chicago. And you see that even today with the young musicians you even mentioned, that it's not just straight ahead what you might find on the coast. It's something different because of all of the influences that are coming together here.
And what's really great, too, is that these young artists don't sound like the 1960s. They're not retro artists, but they're very much aware of this legacy, and they're doing it their own way. And I think that's so wonderful.
I interviewed, and a lot of the people you met, Raven Lanae, we've had on the program a couple times. She performed live here, and Jamila Woods as well. But I interviewed a couple of people, and I can't remember exactly who it was who said this, and it might have been one of Chance's guys. But this idea that they all went to Chicago public schools, And we talked to Ramsey Lewis about this as well. But the idea that now if you're going to, you might get in a selective enrollment school, or you might get into a magnet school and you actually live on the south side, but you go to school on the north side. Or you go to After School Matters programs that are downtown, or you go to the Harold Washington Library and after school programs that take you from your house and make you travel. But because of that, because these kids are coming from all walks of Chicago and the suburbs and everywhere to mix and mingle in ways that they never did before, that you're actually seeing a new form of what you talk about in your book and what happened with the 60s soul music happening with these artists today from Chicago in 2019.
It's incredible. And also, too, a lot of the – and that's all the positive stuff. The negative is that they're also still facing a lot of the barriers. Segregation is still very much a part of Chicago today as it was then. Artists still have to negotiate these different terrains, territories with this, you know, long-standing social structure that's still happening. So it's both positive and, you know, negative too. But again, that's a whole another book that I think should be written.
We've got three or four new books for you to work on.
Well,
coming out
I don't
of this
know
interview.
About that.
You know, your takeaway from this project, from working on this, like you said, for 7 years to put this together and to have the ability to interview all these different people. At the end of the day, when you put this all together, what is the takeaway? What is the message of what these musicians in Chicago were doing at that time?
The takeaway is that these musicians who had to deal with so many harsh realities and so much that, you know, that's again a whole nother book, and that they were able to create unique, distinctive art, and that they were able to work collectively or individually to do it is such an important lesson, and that they wouldn't let anything stop them from doing what they did. And that is such inspiration to hopefully everybody.
Aaron's book is called Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power, and he's going to be up on the Northwest Side next Wednesday night at 2112, the Arts Incubator up there, which is 4243 Knox?
4245 North Knox.
North Knox, and he'll be talking about the book and doing an event, and possibly some of the people from the book show up.
So. Possibly. That would be great.
That
and
would be great.
It would also be great. I also want to give a shout-out to LaVon, my wife, and my mom, Kayla, my dad, Sheldon. We'll all be there.
That's awesome. I'll be there. Aaron Cohen, the author of Move On Up. Thanks so much for being my guest tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a great show. Honored to be here.